In the coming week, President Trump's second impeachment reverberates in Congress. The inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden is set to take place in Washington amid increased security concerns, and the incoming Biden team is poised to ramp up COVID-19 vaccine distribution. It's January 14th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, we have to kick off this week's show by talking about the news coming out of the U.S. House of Representatives. Just yesterday, the House voted to impeach President Trump for the second time, citing last week's mob attack on the Capitol building. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi referred to President Trump as a, let me quote her here, clear and present danger to the nation we all love. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who opposed impeachment, nonetheless said that, quote, the president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress. So can you bring us up to speed, Bob, on what has happened and what is likely to unfold over the next week or so?
Yeah, Jim. So as you said, there were some strong words in a really abbreviated impeachment trial that unfolded. It was about 2 hours of debate. And Nancy Pelosi, as you said, had some strong words, as did other Democrats who were describing the scenes of the occupation of the Capitol and the breaching of the Capitol and the destruction that took place, their own concern about their safety, what it meant to the country's sense of security and stability, and linking it all to the words that President Trump, you know, gave to the crowd right before it marched up and breached the Capitol. As Nancy Pelosi said, this was not a part of a political base, in her words, to be catered or managed. They were domestic terrorists and justice must prevail, end quote. As you said, the Republicans were saying, even while a number of them, including Kevin McCarthy, were critical of the president's actions and said censure would be more appropriate, others just sort of said that this is a rush process, that it will only serve to further divide the country. The president's actions, they said, did not meet the legal standard for incitement and so forth. So what happens next is, as impeachments do, as we learned a year ago during the first impeachment of President Trump, was it goes to the Senate. This time, a bit more nebulous than it was a year ago, where it was very clear that it was going nowhere in the Senate. And even with a slight Democratic control of the Senate, it still appears to fall far short of what would require a conviction in this case. But it's still unclear, Jim, about whether the Senate, the process of holding a trial to determine whether to convict Trump, could bar him from ever running again after he's out of office. Do you have any other ideas, Jim, about how this could unfold? What are the precedents?
Certainly, Bob. I think there are a number of important questions here that we probably want to iron out. One, if the Senate were to vote to convict Donald Trump on this one charge, then the Senate could vote on whether to bar him from ever holding office again. But as you noted, to convict Donald Trump requires 67 votes. It's really hard to see that we're going to get to 67 given what's currently known. If you were to get it, though, again, the Senate could vote by simple majority vote to bar Donald Trump from running again. Again, I think that's unlikely. One question many people are probably wondering is it even constitutional to have an impeachment trial for someone who no longer holds office? And first response there is the Constitution says nothing about that one way or the other, which leaves you looking at history and you can find precedent. And the precedent comes during the presidency of Ulysses S. Grant. So we're talking back in the 1870s in the controversy involved his Secretary of War, a gentleman named William Belknap. Now, Belknap was taking payoffs. The amount of money was, in today's figures, probably around $500,000. And when the House of Representatives learned about this, they started an investigation. It went very, very quickly. And indeed, it was just a matter of days from when the investigation began until the House voted on articles of impeachment. And they actually passed unanimously. Now, Secretary Belknap, realizing that he was about to be impeached, rushed over to the White House and sought to resign. His resignation was accepted by Grant, even though he had left office. The Senate had a trial. A question came up as to whether or not the Constitution allowed you to try someone who is no longer in office. It went back and forth in this. Not surprisingly, the vote split to some extent along party lines, with Belknap or President Grant's fellow Republicans arguing that it didn't. So in the end of the day, while you got a majority vote to convict, it didn't reach the two-thirds level. Now, again, if you you're a legal scholar, what those facts mean is you can argue it both ways. You can argue that, look, we've had it happen in the past, so it's clearly some precedent. And if you want to take the contraposition, you can argue that the reason many Republicans back in 1873 voted to acquit was precisely because they didn't think it was proper to have a trial on impeachment charges for someone who was no longer in office.
So there is the precedent, as you laid out, Jim, but in so many other ways, as in so many other examples, this presidency is unprecedented, and it includes a president who remains extremely popular in his party. We just see some new data on that from a poll from Axios Ipsos, basically saying, you know, far from being a diminished political figure, as some reports are showing, President Trump, as soon to be ex-President Trump, will still command a powerful base, seemingly, and that may be a reason why we're seeing some of the actions or the votes by Republicans and why a number of Republicans may not move forward with any sort of conviction of him. So it just seems like big questions remain about the extent to which the events, which I think shocked a lot of people and aroused a lot of concern among people of both major political parties, the extent to which that is really, at the end of the day, going to spell the end of Trumpism and why things are, the concern about divisions is only growing now.
Well, Bob, I think you're exactly right that we're not seeing the end of Trumpism. Indeed, I can hear the opening bars of Tammy Wynette's country classic, Stand By Your Man, because that's what happened yesterday. House Republicans stood by President Trump. I know a lot's been made in the news media of 10 House Republicans voting for impeachment, including Liz Cheney, who's number 3 in the House Republican leadership. But the more remarkable fact is that more than 90% of House Republicans voted against impeachment. And yes, very few of them defended the president's actions, but they clearly weren't willing to take the step to repudiate the president's behavior. And a lot of that no doubt reflects the fact, as you point out, President Trump remains very popular even after what happened on January 6th. But there's also something troubling, Bob, that has been percolating up, and that has been allegations that some members of Congress may themselves have abetted or been complicit in the events of January 6th, this mob overrunning Capitol Hill. What do you make of that?
That's among the intriguing, disturbing subplots that are playing out, Jim, because there's been a tremendous amount of work, we should say, in the aftermath by various law enforcement authorities to try to unravel what happened. And it includes police, whether they were Capitol Hill police or off-duty police involved in the breach. It involves military, including former military or current military who took part in the breach as well. And then there's the question of, were there actually House members who were actively involved in helping, assisting, and encouraging the actions that we saw unfold? There's certainly some who have been vocally and loudly supporting the president's claims of fraud in the election since Election Day, basically, and have not yielded. We should also note that even after the breach, the same day, a large number of Republican House members still voted against validating the Electoral College results, which some Republican senators decided not to do, but a large number, more than 100 of House Republican lawmakers did so. So there is strong activism on the side of President Trump there. And there are some that allegations have been raised against. I don't know the extent to which there's being any formal investigation, Jim, but I know Capitol Hill Police just announced, and the new leadership there have announced that they're going to be conducting a thorough investigation and urgent investigation as well into all this. We're seeing also, Jim, the unusual specter of House members needing to walk through metal detectors before they can come into the building and facing stiff fines if they don't. Some have rejected that. And also, on top of it, all the wearing of masks. So on top of everything else, we have within the very U.S. Congress really sharp lines being drawn in some cases, and it's only adding to the problems. I should add that we had in the last couple of days some of the first comments from President Trump himself, where he does not regret his comments, but he does call clearly for no violence in and around the inauguration. He also does not step back from his claims that the elections are a fraud. So you still have a large number of people, according to many indications, polling and otherwise, who think Biden is not the real president of the United States, that he was elected in a fraudulent vote, and all of which, Jim, has given rise to security concerns. So as per your original question, are there members of Congress involved? It's something I think that's getting a great deal of attention as this investigation continues to unfold. On top of that, there is the security concern that is causing Washington to be locked down to the inauguration in a way I don't think we've seen, certainly in our lifetimes, but certainly a good century or so. But Jim, I'm wondering if you have any sense of further of how this security scene is unfolding in the next week or so.
Happy to do that, Bob. But before I do, I want to make three quick points on what we were just discussing. One is, though the president keeps making these allegations of widespread electoral fraud, there is absolutely no evidence that's the case. Even his own attorney general, Bill Barr, said that. Second, I do think we're going to get an investigation of everything surrounding the events of January 6th, and we'll sort of get through and distinguish between the rumors and the facts. But one important question that investigation is going to have to tackle is why the Capitol Hill police were so unprepared for what happened, but also why the response took so long once you knew you had a problem on your hand, and why the response to the attack looked so different than how we saw the federal government handle protests this summer regarding Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, and the rest. And the third thing is, again, the big takeaway from the events of the last week is that this country remains deeply divided. It doesn't really look like we're going to be able to bridge that divide. And that's going to have a long shadow over what happens. Donald Trump is going to leave office. Joe Biden's going to come in. Lots of offices are going to change. End of the day, we're still going to have a country that doesn't agree on big things and is angry at one another. But speaking about the security situation here in D.C., it is a lockdown that really has no precedent. We have something on the order of 20,000 National Guard troops deployed to Washington to keep the peace. I'm sure a lot of people have seen the photos and video of National Guard troops sleeping on the marble floors on Capitol Hill. Much of the area around the National Mall, around Congress, around the White House, essentially is off limits to people right now. If you have businesses in the area of Washington bordering the mall, chances are you've had to shutter because of the really unprecedented security operations being launched. And they're being launched partly because of what happened on January 6th. And since, you know, if something just happened, you're very sensitive and you tend to act, but also because the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and other federal agencies are reporting lots of intelligence that we may see a repeat of the violence that we saw on January 6th. Now, some of that evidence has suggested that maybe something surrounding Inauguration Day. Other evidence suggests it may happen this weekend, but that there are people who want to go out and protest. And I shall note that it's not just in Washington, D.C., but there's concern about all 50 states, particularly state capitals, that we may see not peaceful protests, but protests that morph into mob violence. Again, in this situation, there's a lot of chatter. Much of it is probably empty, but some of it, as we saw on January 6th, isn't.
Yeah, and I think we're looking at an inauguration week and day, again, like no other. It was already going to be a stripped-down affair because of concerns about COVID-19 and the Biden team's own wishes that it be a more modest affair that public, in large part, stay away. But this is supposed to be about, at the end of the day, an important moment for the U.S. to celebrate itself, a peaceful transfer of power, something democracies are supposed to be baked in, especially to the world's oldest democracy. And yet, we're looking at the very nature of that under threat, Jim. Among other things at this event, President Trump will not be there. Vice President Pence is expected to be there. There's not a lot else known about what the agenda is at this point. Jim, could you talk a bit about what you see unfolding in terms of the process, what the speech might cover, or what the tone might need to be?
Well, Bob, you're right. This is going to be a vastly scaled down event compared to anything that we have seen in the past, both because of the pandemic and the security concerns. Things like the parade will now be virtual. We do know that Lady Gaga is scheduled to sing the national anthem. There's going to be some time for Jennifer Lopez to perform some musical series. But obviously the big thing on Inauguration Day, besides the fact that it is happening and you have traditionally an orderly and peaceful transfer of power, something I don't think we're quite living up to this year. There's the swearing in and then the president's speech. And I think that's a big challenge for Joe Biden. What does the right speech for this moment in time look like? Now, if you look over the history of presidential inaugurations, you can find some soaring speeches. John F. Kennedy's probably leads the way, but people also would cite Thomas Jefferson's 1801 speech or Ronald Reagan's 1981 inaugural address. But what is the right speech to give for this moment? You know, Joe Biden has campaigned on this notion that he's going to unite America. He's going to bring us back together. He's going to help us find our common purpose. But as we just discussed, it is very clear that we don't agree on a common purpose. We have divided up into tribes. We're screaming at each other. We can't find common ground. So how do you give a speech? What's the right tone so that it resonates? And I think that's going to be a very big challenge for Biden and his speechwriters.
And related to that, Jim, is the way in which this speech is broadcast. We are at this dividing point for a lot of reasons, but among them is the pervasive disinformation going on. And so are Americans, you know, sort of reacting to the same information, to the same speech? Is it going to be broadcast? Or is there going to be some sort of fake words put in President-elect Biden's mouth and that used to further distort things? If he does, you know, issue what he hopes to be a unifying message and talking about, you know, major stimulus plans and reaching the people who have been hit hardest by a variety of things, including the pandemic. Does that message get through in the way that he intended? All of these things are now up for grabs. They were sort of assumptions in the past, but the quote-unquote mainstream media is deeply resented and really rejected by many people, including many who were involved in the breach of the Capitol. And so how will that play? At the end of the day, it's going to be his actions in office, especially in the first 100 days, that might sway some people at the margins. But it is hard to see that getting to the core issues that are fanning the flames here, Jim, including his very credibility as the next president.
You're quite right, Bob. And I think it is important to note that what you say isn't necessarily what people hear, or perhaps put it differently, people are going to be looking for things in that speech that confirm beliefs they already have. And that's a real challenge. And, you know, the other sort of challenge for Biden is how soaring does he go? How specific does he get? Does he have a speech that is long on his aspirations? Or does he talk about some of the specific things that he wants to do? That's the kind of choice decision that he and his speechwriting team are going to have to make. And again, if you go back and look at presidential inaugural addresses, they range from George Washington's second inaugural address, which ran 135 words. That's about two recitations of the Lord's Prayer, to William Henry Harrison in 1841, giving a speech that lasted 2 hours and ran some 8,800 words. So inaugural addresses fall all across the range. And let's face it, most of them are forgettable. I think that the Biden team is hoping that President Biden, when he gives his first speech to the nation, will be able to say something memorable and meaningful to the American public to make his agenda go forward. And again, I don't think they labor under any illusions about how difficult the political terrain is going to be coming out of the gate. Obviously, Bob, one of the big things that the Biden administration is going to have to do early on, and they flagged, is to make it a priority to get COVID-19 and the pandemic under control, because that's the key to getting the economy running again, is getting the virus contained. And I'll say right now we're seeing daily death rates exceeding 4,000 people per day. There's no sign that's going to ebb anytime soon. There's some fears those numbers may go even higher. So what do we know about what the Biden administration is going to do starting day one with vaccines and vaccine distribution?
Yeah, Jim. Well, we're going to have probably at the time this podcast drops a speech from President-elect Biden about his vaccine plan. Big part of it being what they're calling 100 million people reached in the first 100 days. And what does that involve? Not sure how many details can come out in the speech, but there has been a great emphasis on the federal government kind of messaging more regularly and more in a more straightforward fashion and coordinating with states and localities on making this happen. It's likely to involve as well a financial aspect, you know, how much aid do these states and localities need? I was listening just recently to your latest President's Inbox podcast, Jim, with our colleagues Tom Boyke and Jennifer Nuzzo. And Tom had referred to the coordination between the federal and state and local level as a slow-moving disaster. I think they both talked about things that are now finally moving in place, but there had been plans for 20 million vaccinations to be distributed by the end of 2020. I think it's about 10 million as we went to tape this podcast, Jim. So 100 million in 100 days is quite bold. People like to hear that. There are certainly strides being reported nearly every day on the vaccine development front. I just saw a new one about Johnson & Johnson with a one-shot vaccine that's starting to show some promise. So it's these sort of tantalizing reporting of technical progress with the sort of bureaucratic morass that we're still dealing with. What can Biden say that will make that better? I think the devil will be in the details.
Certainly will, Bob, and he faces a number of challenges. Let me flag two of them. One is vaccine uptake. It is a big question as to how many Americans are going to be willing to get the vaccination, to be inoculated. Polls have sort of fluctuated on that, suggesting maybe 60, 70% of Americans will. Now, maybe that will go higher, maybe not. And of course, it gets tied into the question of what do you need to get so-called herd immunity? That is, enough people either suffer from the disease and have natural immunity or have been inoculated so that it's hard to have outbreaks because the virus doesn't encounter people who are susceptible to getting it. So that's going to be a big issue. And another thing is going to be the issue of mutation. This is a virus that mutates. We've already seen evidence of a mutation that was first identified in London that has appeared elsewhere in the world, which is a more infectious, not necessarily more lethal, but a more infectious version of the virus, meaning it can be passed along more easily. And of course, even if you have the same level of lethality, but it's more infectious, that more infectious virus will kill more people because it infects more people. So that's going to be a really big challenge. And there are questions being raised, and I'm not a scientist, so I don't know where it's all going to net out, but could you have a mutation that reduces the efficacy of the vaccine? There have been reports that there have been some mutations identified in South Africa, for example, and concerns that that particular mutation may render the current set of vaccines ineffective. Now, the positive note there is, given the way this particular vaccine, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines were developed, scientists seem to be pretty confident they can do the kinds of tweaks needed to be able to restore or preserve the efficacy, much like the flu shot changes each year. But this could be, could be a public health challenge that isn't, quote, solved, you know, by August 2021, but it could be an ongoing health challenge, much like the flu can be an ongoing health challenge.
Yeah, and I would just note on one of those aspects, Jim, which is the degree to which people are willing to get the vaccine. You certainly see anecdotally a great deal of interest in terms of the lines throughout the country. You do see pushback, though, against any sort of public health messaging coming from the federal government, from the people who are sympathetic to the Capitol Hill attack, for example, the QAnon conspiracy people, and others who may not be part of that crowd, but are still wary of vaccines in general. And so add to that the still curious nature of COVID-19, in which there are a number of people have had the vaccine showing no symptoms whatsoever. So it kind of feeds this sort of sense that, well, it's really something that just sort of sick and old people get and we don't need to worry about it. The numbers you mentioned at the beginning, though, are quite alarming, Jim. 4,000 now, 4,000 a day. We could be close to 400,000 deaths by the inauguration day itself. I do think there's a critical mass of the country that is taking this seriously now. So one hopes that with consistent messaging and with sort of a collective sense of obligation that we will reach this herd immunity that you talked about, and that you have, if not the summer, then by the end of 2021, a better sense of this under control. But it's enormous, and it's on top of so many other things. It would be enormous in and of itself with a united nation, Jim. But again, just to hit the point home, we have a divided nation, and it stretches to issues like public health policy.
I wish I could say I disagree with you, Bob, but I can't and I don't.
And that's our look at the world next week from Washington. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. A team of scientists from the WHO is in the Chinese city of Wuhan to investigate the origins of the COVID-19 outbreak. A parliamentary conference of the German Bundestag and the French National Assembly takes place in Versailles. And the Africa Cup of Nations soccer tournament is set to be hosted by Cameroon.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrera and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.